to be presenting to you this afternoon. Can I just start with a couple of questions? How many of you have been involved with classical education for 10 years or more? Do you care to raise your hands? Okay. Look around. About five people put their hands up. These are the veterans among us. How many of you have been involved between 5 and 10 years? How many of you have been involved for 1 year or less? Okay, most of you. And how many between, say, 2 and 5 years? Be the rest of you. Over half of you, by my estimation, are newly involved, coming into classical Christian education. And it's probably one reason why you're at this seminar, because you're trying to sort it out and define it and clarify it. What is classical education? And at first, it may seem to be obvious. We're doing education, and we all know what that means, right? And we're doing it classically. So it must be kind of highbrow, sophisticated, and elitist. And the kids wear uniforms. Well, there's more to it than that, and there's many different levels of definition and many nuances. It's just the way language works. And this particular word, classical, has gone through many permutations. It, after all, has a history that's much older than our own lives. And so it has the right to have picked up many connotations over the centuries. And when you use the word classical, all of those connotations remain attached to it. The trouble is, the person you're speaking to may not know which connotations you're referring to, because usually you're referring to a cluster of several at once. The trouble is, you yourself might not know exactly what connotations you're referring to. It's a cool sounding word, though. And we want to be classical, whatever that may be. Imagine being invited to a church. I'd like you to come to my church. Well, what kind of a church is it? It's a Christian church. Oh, well, could you tell me a little bit more? What kind of a Christian church? Well, it's a religious Christian church. Yes, and it's an American Christian church. American, Christian, religious. Oh, and it's historic. It's traditional. Would you know what you're in for when you visit that church? Probably not. A new teacher on our staff was sharing from the beginning, I'm assuming that the meaning of words are their use. And words typically pick up connotations and meaning as they are being used. When Webster put together the dictionary, he didn't create meanings for these words. He went out and figured out how these words were being used, and then he recorded these uses for us and definitions. So words change and evolve, and that's why there's a need for new editions of dictionaries all the time. And the word classical, as well as the word education, are big concept words that tend to be mushy and that have evolved over time. So we need to take a second look. What seems obvious at first, kind of like looking at the snow, it's white, it's fluffy, it's powdery, is really much more complex. Each snowflake has its own design, and it exists in various patterns and so on. So we're going to take a second look today, and my goal is to help us to understand what we are, who we are, and what we're doing, and what others are doing under the rubric of classical education, and then to communicate clearly and effectively to others, like prospective parents, who we are and what we're doing, to know who we are and to be able to communicate that to others who want to know who we are. Those are important things to be able to do. There's been a tendency to simplify to schools, historically speaking. Education sometimes has been in schools, sometimes not, sometimes in various combinations. Webster's, I think, is right by saying in this modern situation, it's especially by formal schooling, but not always. Anybody here homeschooling? Care to raise your hand? Okay. So you're included. What is classical? Many definitions, of course. It's the tried and true. It's enduring excellence. It's that which is traditional and well appreciated. And it's that which is of or relating to the classical period. There's a generic definition for you. There are broad and narrow tendencies. It's broad in this sense. The traditional, the old-fashioned, the old, the standard, the accepted, the historic, the highbrow, the elitist. If you listen to classical music, people tend to think classical music is something that refined people do. And as Jesse, my colleague, said on the way down, he said that if you listen to classical music, you either like it or pretend to. Because it's the refined thing to do. That connotation, broad, I think is present in the definition of classical. And it's going to have an impact on your work in a classical Christian school. And those of you who have been involved in the movement know this. You appear to some, right out of the gate, just by using the word classical, as, can you fill in the blank? Elitist. Blue blood. Refined. A cut above. Do you see my nose rising? My eyebrows rising? Just by the use of the word. And if the meaning of words is their use, and this is a legitimate use that floats around today in America, you have to be aware of it and fight against it, unless you are, of course, elitist and blue blood and highbrow and all of those things. Then more power to you. You're being honest, even if you're arrogant. There are some narrow tendencies as well. Classical is used in some specific ways, not just broad ways, but some narrow specific ways, as in Plato's Academy. There was a classical academy, if ever there was one. The Sophists themselves, the Roman Ludus, the medieval universities were classical universities. Mortimer Adler's Paideia Project, attempting to bring classical education into public schools. The best education for some, he said, is the best education for all. Some have called this a democratic classicism. The American colonial education has been called classical. St. John's College has been called classical. Dorothy Sayre's essay has been called an essay on classical education. Certainly our friend Doug Wilson, the ACCS, the CSL, the Circe Institute, Ed Hirsch's core curriculum, Charlotte Mason, Play and Discovery, the university model, Susan Wise Bowers, the well-trained mind, all specifically refer to themselves as a specific form of classical education. So you can see how easy it is to get lost in the woods. But when we speak of classical education, we're certainly speaking of content and method as well. And I think this is a helpful distinction to make. Classical in content, classical in method. It's not the only way to slice this, but it's a helpful way. By the way, let me interject this here. I think there are that you don't. That doesn't mean that I'm wrong or that you're right. It means that language is imprecise and we have to work at it. Content and method. Content, great learning and literature of the West. Method, close reading of texts and ideas. Mastery of the fundamentals early. Discipline, diligence, and obedience. That's about it if we're going to be general about content and method in classical education. Let me try another way of classifying it. I'll give you some headings that I think describe myself, I could be wrong, accurately, classical education. The humanities, or the seven liberal arts, in terms of content, the trivium and the quadrivium. Western texts, generally. People talk about the Eastern great books, okay, so you can start to qualify, but generally, Western great books. It's textual. It's integrated, part of a great conversation, Mortimer Adler said. It's systematic, and it's moral. It has as its aim virtue. These things, I think, are legitimate generalizations in reference to classical education. But boy, pause here for a moment again. You might see in your mind a tree, a classification tree, with classical education at the very top, and then you begin to see subcategories, and within each subcategory there are more subcategories. Unfortunately, with a concept like this, it's just the way it is. That's how we find truth and make matters clear. So, at the top level of the tree, the most general statement and definition of classical education, let's argue about that too. And then at every category and subcategory, we can also argue and discuss. the ACCS invites other organizations and educators into a civilized discussion and debate. I really appreciate that about the ACCS. That's exactly what we need to do to grow and deepen our understanding, even about these matters and even about our first principles. There's a need for clear definition at every level. And as an example of this, I cite the variety of expressions or manifestations of classical Christian education in the ACCS right now. There's no way you can avoid it, we're human. But as you start a school, it's going to begin to evolve. You need a clear mission. You need a clear statement of purpose. You need outcomes that you're hoping to achieve and that you can measure. Yes, there is a kind of Christian classical outcome-based education. What are we seeking to produce? Chuck and Robert of Wisdom and Eloquence suggest that we should have a 12 through K curriculum. That we should start intentionally with the end in mind. What do you want to see your graduate look like? What skills, what knowledge, what virtue, what character? And then work backwards so that your curriculum and your methodology get you there. There's variety in the approaches that are being taken. You need a clear purpose, but then as you begin to implement that purpose, you'll find things start to happen that you didn't expect. So here's just a brief summary, and I'm going to generalize here, and I apologize in advance, but I've found that there's at least five different flavors of classical Christian education in the movement today. So those of you who are starting schools, listen and ask yourself which resonates with you. Those of you who are in schools right now, listen and try and figure out which one you're closest to, and if you have a new category, come up to me afterwards so I can put it on my list. There's the prep school model that essentially takes the American preparatory school model, which keeps the subjects fairly separate, the traditional sectoring of subjects, and then adds Latin, logic, rhetoric, and grammar as distinct disciplines and subjects. That's about it. We're going to be like Boys Latin outside of Baltimore, or Georgetown Prep in Washington, D.C. We're going to do all these, we're going to do math really well, literature really well, but we're going to add Latin, we're going to add logic, we're going to add rhetoric, we're going to teach grammar really well in the lower school, and that's pretty much what we're going to do. That's one variety that does exist. There's another variety which I call the high integrationist model, which begins to erase the boundary lines between disciplines, especially in the upper school, so that the distinctions between literature, history, and theology begin to melt away and they all become one web of knowledge. Okay, there's an insight there. High integration with boundaries that are very, very thin or maybe almost non-existent. Then there's what I might call the dynamic eclectic approach that employs the liberal arts generally without as much consideration to the sequencing of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Dynamic in the sense that it's willing to move and adapt and willing to have rhetoric, say, present in some form, even in the lower school, and not as convinced that the grammar, logic, rhetoric sequence should be that tight, should be more, these subjects should be more loose, the sequence should be more loosely conceived, and perhaps that all the liberal arts should be present in the curriculum, not just those three. By the way, on that matter, I'd say there's a continuum of difference in the ACCS. I don't know of a single ACCS school that doesn't teach math. But it's not a trivium subject. So do you see what I mean? It's a matter of degree. You might be very much in the camp of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, elementary school, middle school, high school, the trivium all the way, trivium-based education, but you teach math, and you teach science, you teach geometry, maybe not astronomy, but you do the quantitative arts too, right? So it's a matter of degree then. So we do the trivium and the quadrivium. So how are we going to employ it, though, is the question. And these eclectic, more dynamic schools are going to be more fluid in the way they employ their curriculum and all seven of the liberal arts. A fourth approach is what I would call the paradigmatic approach that takes these subjects, like grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and holds them forth as paradigms that have a strong emphasis at various times, but don't control the entire curriculum. They just become a kind of lens by which the other subjects are looked at as well. So for example, in the rhetoric school, when you're studying literature, You have a dedicated course in rhetoric, but you're also employing rhetoric skills in your literature class. You're learning some rhetorical devices even in literature, and you're having your students use their rhetoric skills even as they write their English papers. So rhetoric becomes kind of a paradigm discipline which has influence in the other areas, but the other subjects and areas also have their own independent existence. It's kind of a hybrid approach. And then lastly, I would cite the university model and the Charlotte Mason model, another hybrid approach that involves going to school maybe 2 to 3 days a week, especially in the lower school, involves incorporating play and discovery a la Charlotte Mason, and includes that with an emphasis on the trivium subjects. An interesting blend. Any of you part of a university model school? Please raise your hand. Any of you using Charlotte Mason in some fashion in your schools? Okay, there's one over there, and there's a few others. And I know there are other kinds of blends and mixtures that are occurring within the ACCS. Let's move on.